Beate Spirituality Center presents Muffin Talk with Beate.
Kia ora and welcome back to today's Muffin Talk. Today my visitor is Peter Firkin. Peter is a New Zealander visiting Auckland from his home in London, and he has been away for more than 30 years. Peter would like to start the interview with a short prayer.
Lord, we ask you to guide our conversation, and may all that we do be for your will and under your guidance. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Peter. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
You grew up in Auckland, and in fact you used to live in the same road where our Mercy Spirituality Centre is located, in Epsom, in the Drive.
Right opposite, yes. I went to the church for many years. Yes.
What a surprise.
And very nice surprise.
Yes, you visited the Mercy Spirituality Center before the interview, and you had the chance to go back to your childhood or your young adulthood?
Probably from about 13 onwards. So yes, it was very nice to visit and to see the changes, but also to see that the site was being used for such spectacularly great use. It's wonderful.
Thank you. I hope that one day you'll have the chance to speak there. And next time when you come for a longer time, this time we are happy to have you at least for this interview on the radio. You said that you are currently working for a local authority in London.
That's right.
Running two children's centres.
Mm-hmm.
And these children's centres provide services for families with children under the age of 5.
That's right, yeah.
And you're also a visiting lecturer at the City University in London.
That's right, yeah.
Peter, can you tell me a little bit about yourself? And, I believe you are a member of the Young Christian Workers in Auckland. Can you tell me something about them and how your involvement influenced your future?
Okay, well, the Young Christian Workers, which was an organization developed within the Catholic Church in the 1950s and 60s, in New Zealand in that period, it replaced the Catholic Youth Movement as the significant youth organization within the parishes. And so within Auckland, we had a number of groups and parishes made up of people who had left school and were in the work environment. And it was a real mixture of social activities. We had quite an extensive social activity, but also really bringing a practical and active spirituality based on Catholicism into their lives and maintaining their contact with Catholicism, but with a very strong social agenda. I mean, the organization looked very much not just at the person's spirituality, but how that was represented in their work and how it was represented in the activities and a lot of the programs that we were involved in. So there was work done looking at the issue around fairness for apprentices, and so there was some work done around that. And it was also a very strong educational program, so we had camps and training programs. And I think for me, it was also a very much a community of interest. The very well-known Father Terry Dibble was the chaplain at the time, and we were supported by somebody from the Senecal Nuns called Sister Mary Kay, who I think is now based in London, based in Wellington. And those people provided a real core experience of being together and supporting each other. And there were a number of the people who worked and were part of that organization who lived within houses together and shared the experiences of being together as young people. And so it was a very powerful time. I don't think I realized quite how influential some of it was till about a year ago when, just before his death, I was reflecting on my time with Terry and realized how much his attitude and the YCW attitude of reflection, was very much something which had completely driven my life. But also I think it had driven my life in the sense that my spirituality was very much using, I think it's Paul who said, know me by my deeds. You can know me by prayer, but my deeds indicate really what I'm about. And I think that was very much how YCW worked, is our spirituality was very much about our deeds and the activities and the community that we're involved in. So they've been a very powerful influence.
And what was the first contact to that movement?
It was actually in in the church in Banff Avenue, just behind the Mercy Centre. There was a local community person called Helen Digan, who was the leader of the small YCW group, and we lived about five doors apart. And so when I was leaving school, she invited me to join the group at Banff Avenue. And from that grew the contact, and within 15 to 18 months, I'd become quite active in the group and received an extensive amount of training and development, which took me forward. So it was through the church behind the Mercy Centre. Real connections here today.
Yes, very much. And how many people were in that group? You said you became a member. So how many members were there?
In the local group, there was probably only about 10 or 12 active members. There were always people, but some of the big groups, such as the group which is based in Henderson, had 20 or 30 members, and some of the other groups dotted around Auckland varied from 10 members to 20, 25 members. Mm-hmm. Clearly, when there were social activities, the group grew very quickly. When it came to doing work, the group maybe had been a bit smaller. And then at the core, there was always a full-time worker. So in my time, it was a guy called Alf Kirk, followed by Colin Wilson, and probably half a dozen to a dozen really active people, Carol Thomas, Mary McManus, and people like that, who were really at the core of the organisation and were very key in its growth and development with Terry. Mm-hmm.
You said 10 to 12 to 20. That sounds like a real nice community where everyone knows each other, and it's a good group to work with, good size of group.
I think that's very true. I think that particularly the core organization was very, very, very supportive of each other. And although after about two or three years through my work, wasn't in regular contact with them, they were always a group who I would go back to, who would reference to, or who at different times I would actually see as my mentors and my supporters. And certainly Terry and Sister Mary Kay were very much those mentors and those supporters. So it was very much a community feel. And always Terry was living in houses where there was a number of young people, either workers within the organisation or other people who'd come to London. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, people like James K. Baxter, who stayed with Terry and was very close to Terry on odd occasions. So you would often open the door and there would be James K. Baxter standing there and looking for Terry. So it was very much that growth. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And was that your motivation to become a community worker?
I don't think I could have done anything else. I was lucky in the sense that I moved into the Department of Internal Affairs into a job called a youth advisory officer. And that really came about because Terry told me that somebody who had held the job was a Catholic, who had been a member of the Catholic Young Christian Workers and was moving on. And he gave me the heads up and told me about that. And it was just a continuation of what we were doing in the sense of trying to work with young people in a variety of ways, which then broadened out to a much range of community activities. I don't think people often say to me, because I've got a very sort of mixed up CV, gosh, you've got a chequered sort of CV. And I would say, well, you know, it's just happened to me. It's happened through, I say, you know, God opened the door and I walked through it. And I think that was very much from YCW, was God opened the door to the next step, which led to the next step. And it never occurred to me that it wouldn't be something which was about community or about people or in some way like that.
That sounds great. And you really have a passion for young people. And I believe that while you were still in New Zealand, you trained the FAB in leadership and trained in Youth Line. And both groups support young people. The FAB provides weekly social experience for young people with disabilities, and the Youth Line provides counseling services for young people. And so you've been a community advisor and a community worker. Hmm. You've been committed to social change. What kind of challenges were you facing in your work?
I think in New Zealand, because we're talking about the 70s, when community development was really at its heart and there was such a lot of activity, and we're talking about, well, FAB, of course, was originated by Joan Lardner, who's very involved with the station, but also Youth Line was developed by Felix Donnelly, again, another Catholic priest, who was very much working with young people who were struggling with their identity. And I think New Zealand was coming into a stage where it had gone from being quite a rural-based community to being one where cities were causing all sorts of issues both for Maori and for Pacific Island young people, as well as for Pākehā youth coming into the cities or experiencing the cities growing very rapidly. So there was all sorts of issues going on with which those people picked up on and which were very core at the process. You say, what kind of challenges I'm facing in my work? I think historically, the issue was always going to be, for me, those in power recognizing the needs of those who were not in power or had no power in those situations. Mm-hmm. And I think that anyone who was working in those times, and I left in 1980 when much more of the issues around land and around community rights and those sorts of things became more key to those things. But in the 1970s, it was very much leading up to those with many community-based organizations doing wonderful work to develop the communities and bringing that sense of trying to develop and take responsibility for years. But it was always a challenge between those who didn't see there was a need versus those who saw there was a need or the nature of the need or what was the priority. And I don't think 40 years later that's changed. I think we're still struggling with those sorts of issues. For me, the second issue has always been, and this is more latterly more powerful for me and probably in the last 15 to 20 years, is the way in which my active Christianity is part of my life. I think there was a real temptation to put that behind you and not speak about that as being the driving force in you. And in the last 15 to 20 years, it's been very much for me making it very clear that that is my driving force.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Peter. For those of you who've just tuned in, you're listening to Muffin Talk with Beate. And my visitor today is Peter Firkin. He has told us about his involvement in community work, and he is a New Zealander who started being involved in community work more than 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you said. Mm-hmm. And you're still working with young people. But you've also been in Africa for a while, and I believe that you were working with child soldiers and to find them, to help them find their way back to society. Can you tell me more about this experience?
My work was really supporting the people who were doing the front line. I was very privileged to meet a woman called Una McCauley who was one of three or four people who specialised in the demilitarisation of children. And for those people in New Zealand who probably aren't familiar with it, for a long time, both armies and rebel groups either directly or indirectly recruited children from 12. The youngest I came across or heard about was 7, but I also encountered children quite young with guns in their hands who were involved in the variety of conflicts which were going on in Africa, either between groups or between the government and whatever. I was invited to take part in a group who were producing a training manual for NGOs on how to deal with children's rights, particularly within conflict zones. And it was funded by Mandela's second wife, who the Canadians written a very influential report on children in conflict, which Mandela's second wife picked up and helped to find the funding for a 2-year program. And so a number of people around the world were invited to write this development manual. And so that led me to field test the manual and work with NGOs. And then lately with Una McCauley to work with soldiers from West African countries particularly, but I was also in East Africa and Somalia and Uganda, Ethiopia. Looking at those issues around how do we help or work with those people who encounter child soldiers. So how do soldiers deal with those issues? How do you deal with them if they want to surrender? All of those sorts of things. And it was very much working with NGOs on the ground, because I think there's a real danger, almost like a colonial attitude, if you're not careful, parachuting in these experts who aren't of the community. So Una and the community and Save the Children Sweden and Save the Children UK very much worked on the principle with the UN about training and developing partnerships on the ground. So we ran workshops in Cote d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast, Liberia, Senegal, Ghana, Ethiopia, working with the local community, field testing the materials and then helping them to increase their skill base and helping them to look at building partnerships with the local military or with peacekeeping operations in order to facilitate the rights of children. and also encouraging them to look at some of the issues around children returning from conflict zones or being returned from those zones and how they reintegrated. Because if you can imagine it, if you can think of a 13 or a 14-year-old who has been kidnapped into a group and then given a lot of responsibility to suddenly be liberated and then go back into his home where he's no longer in charge, where he no longer where he has to give up to his community, then that can be quite a cultural change. And for some of these mm-hmm. children, they may have been in these groups for 2 to 3 years. So often the reintegration was always very difficult, and often there were real issues, social problems. And the Coalition on the Use of Child Soldiers, which is based in London, which I was temporarily on the board of, working very much with the psychosocial problems around those issues and really working now in Latin America with some of these children, trying to reintegrate them back into the community. And it's an ongoing problem. Most governments have signed the optional protocol to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is about that they won't recruit children, but rebel groups don't.
And where did you have the contact with the children? Was it in certain centres that the UN built, or how can I imagine that?
The work was principally through the NGOs. So the few times where I had a lot of contact was either in programs which the NGOs were running or through the work of Erna McCauley and coming in contact with those. Mm. My work was very much helping develop the skill base of those people who were doing the frontline work, because clearly culturally and otherwise it was the basis of developing those processes.
Yeah. So you were training those who were dealing with the children.
Yeah.
So you were not directly, because I was just imagining each of these countries has different languages, and to understand the boys, and are the boys and girls, or
yes,
boys and girls.
Girls clearly not used as combatants, but used for a variety of things, from domestic purposes to sexual partners. And the boys very much used as combats or carrying large loads and those sorts of things. So, no, the contact was very much encouraging and developing those. But at several of the camps that we ran, the French had a very, very good peacekeeping training camp in Cote d'Ivoire where they allowed us to use through UNA's work. And we brought in groups of ex-child soldiers to work with the soldiers to help them understand, and the NGOs. So there were present probably 20 or 30, I think it was about 20 young people who had been child soldiers, ranging from, as I say, 7 up to about 15 or 16.
How was the reaction of the children? Were they welcoming the programs? Do you know anything about that?
Certainly, the children who came to the first camp were very suspicious of the soldiers, for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And the child soldiers were there were soldiers from 9 countries, if I remember rightly. I'm thinking back about 10 years now. And there was a high level of suspicion. I think the thing that broke down a lot of the suspicion was a very brutal game of soccer, which was played between the soldiers and and we biased the referee in favour of the children. So the soldiers got more and more frustrated, which the children found very enjoyable. So it was those sorts of things, which was about helping those people. But, you know, through UNA, I experienced contact either with individuals or people who were in the field and heard lots and lots of stories and was involved with conferences and conversations where people came and told their stories. And it's a disturbing story. Yeah.
Very sad. I remember I once talked to a man who was working with child soldiers in Liberia, and he said, when we integrate the boys, he was usually talking about boys, then we don't allow them to speak about what they did in the war, because once they start speaking about it, they might boast. Oh, and so he said it was forbidden to talk about it, and then they could be integrated a bit easier.
Yeah. And the Catholic Church played a very important part in that in Liberia with the Bosco Society, John Bosco. They work very functional in bringing, providing schools and spaces to those sorts of things. So they were very vital. Liberia is, you know, a tragic example of, yes, of how children were both exploited and but also families were completely destroyed. So not talking about it, but also because often whole villages, if they discovered someone had been a child soldier, there was also history that went with that, so that yes, they would become even greater social outcasts.
Yes. Okay, leaving Africa behind, it's a very sad story. What are you doing now in London?
Okay. As you said at the top of the program, what I do is I run 2 children's centres. I work in a North London borough, and that borough, the government funded, the previous Labour government funded a program called Sure Start, and that was targeted at high-end need families. And then through both political and general pressure, those were broadened out to something called children's centres, which are, mm-hmm. were universal services, so that they're building-based programs aimed at families with children under the five, which provide a range of services from stay and play to parenting programs to one-to-one advice, return to work, Citizens Advice Bureau, health visiting programs, work with families where there are speech and language and development difficulties, as well as a low-level social work type intervention in families. So it's a range of activities. And then I also manage the Fathers Program for the borough. So mm-hmm. I'm responsible with 1.5 other people for providing a program of work with fathers, which again ranges, there's four components to it. We have a Saturday morning fathers and children program for children with fathers with children up to the age of 8. And that's great fun because you get 10 or 20 dads coming in with their children. And we do everything from baby massage through to playing golf. We took all the dads and the children. And remember, these children are all under 8 out to a golf driving range. And the 3-year-olds were beating the dads. So really those fun things. We do some work around one-to-one work with dads where there is issues around either development issues. In other words, they're struggling to be a dad or they're a new dad or a young dad. Then we have a Father's Champions program. That's where we train existing fathers to support other fathers. And we run a number of groups which range from working with people who are going to be new dads through to work where there are issues within the family and supporting those processes.
Yeah. So you support the fathers before they become fathers?
We try to. We've been running the program for 3 years and this is the next phase. We're starting to say, okay, let's get them before they're dads. Let's not wait to live. Yeah. And because a lot of the dads who turn up on the Saturday morning are new dads, we thought, why don't we try and run something beforehand? So we're going to start running something on a regular basis. And we're calling it Pregnant Fathers Program.
Pregnant Fathers. It sounds very innovative.
my father's work is not convinced by the title at the moment, but I like it.
And you also work with in programs with domestic violence.
Well, I think that one of the issues, both within the children's centre, but also often in the breakdown of relationship, is domestic abuse. So we see it much broadly than just the physical violence, emotional abuse, psychological abuse, financial abuse, all of those sorts of things are going on much more hidden within the families. I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, but in actual fact, where there's violence, it often becomes more publicly seen. Mm-hmm. But many women and a small number of men can be suffering from all sorts of other abuse, which may be deprivation of money, stopping people talking mm-hmm. to friends. And that's going to affect both the relationship, but also whoever has been abused, whether it's the woman or the man. But more importantly, there is modelling going on there for the children who are in that family, and they're going to perpetuate this model if we don't get in there and both work with the family to change the dynamics, but also educate the children that this is not the way relationships work, this is not the way families are, and that there are other ways which are about respecting the people that you're with and treating them in a positive and a different way. And for me, that's why I love about the work. You know, started in youth work, worked as a consultant and all sorts of things. But now really what I see is those children under the five, if we can educate them and develop them and bring them through in a really positive way with different role models, with different perceptions, with the concept of extended family and all of those sorts of things, then we can really start to make a difference within society in the next 20 or 30 years.
How do you get in contact with the families?
Well, a significant part of the work is what's called universal services, so anyone can walk through the door. So our stay and play programs, which we run 10 of them a week, are 2-hour sessions where mum or dad or any of the family can bring their child in and play. And that's often where we make first contact. So often they will turn up, and they are often referred. So health visitors in the UK who are health professionals working with families with newborn children up to the age of 2 will often say, "Well, come to the children's centre, bring your child down, and they can play." Mm-hmm. And children who are in families who are in flats or with limited outside space often during the winter, it's a good case to come and play because we've got lots of toys. And we use that as often a starting point. Mm-hmm. Or they may be referred to us because there is a concern the child might be not thriving, or there's the mother comes because she wants some advice on breastfeeding, or she wants some advice about something else. And those little points of contact are often how we make the first contact and then open up the services which are available and suggest a program to people.
Mm-hmm. That sounds very emotional also. You're very passionate for your work.
Yes.
And you said that you got your strength through the Benedictine lay community. Hmm. Can you tell me something about this community? How did you get involved in it and in what way?
The lay community of St. Benedict's is unfortunately mostly a British-based organization based on Benedictine spirituality. For those who don't know, St. Benedict produced a rule which is used by a significant number of monastic orders. And a group of people who lived at the Worth community in the 1960s and 70s, and Worth may be known to a number of your listeners because there was a famous program called The Monastery, where a group of five people were invited to live in the monastery for a number of weeks and experience monastic life, mm-hmm. and it was made into a TV program. And the abbot at that time, I'm going to say Abbot Christopher, and I can't think of his surname, it's gone completely out of my mind, he wrote a number of books called Seeking Sanctuary, and I'd heard about monastic communities, and they'd started to interest me, and I'd done a bit of research, and then I saw the program, and I saw the book, and that immediately attracted me to read more about this, and so I made some inquiries and discovered the group of people who had lived in the monastery in the 1960s and 70s had become this lay community of St. Mm-hmm. Benedict's. Mm-hmm. It consists these days of about 350 families, so it's a non-residential community. It's a dispersed community with a leader and a council. And the more I read about monastic spirituality, in a way the Sisters of Mercies and all of that is a form of monastic community, that spirituality which is built around a community of like-minded people seeking to do God's work in a variety of ways, was a very rich experience, and an experience which I had struggled to find in some of the parishes and dioceses where I lived in London. And then I was invited, I hadn't joined the community, but one of the women, a woman called Emily Hollins, invited me to join something called Lexio Divina Group, which is a way of reading.
Yes, yes.
And that Lexio group met twice a week. And over 4 or 5 years, I gradually became, she said to me, why don't you join the community and become more active in the community? So I joined the community, and we meet several times a year. We run our program of weekends, not unlike the centered runs, but while our home community is probably Worth, we are dispersed around the community. So there are groups who meet monthly and quarterly around the community, around the country, where people can explore and discover that spirituality. Mm-hmm. And it's a very rich community-based spirituality.
Thank you. I can see that the community is the thread through your life.
It is. It is very much.
And thank you very much, Peter, for coming here to the studio. I know that you have little time here in Auckland, and I appreciate very much that you take the time and come to our Muffin Talk.
It's been a pleasure and an enjoyment.
Thank you. And I'd just like to draw your attention to one of our events that is coming up, and that's a Muffin Talk on the 8th of May. It's about Polish culture and the Catholic Church. It because it's now a good time to talk about it, as this coming Sunday on the 27th of April, Pope John Paul II will be canonized. And we are learning more about the Catholic culture in New Zealand. The Polish chaplain, Father Wiesław Pawlowski, is going to come to the Mercy Spirituality Center, 104 The Drive. And if you want to know more about it, look at our website, www.mercyspiritualitycenter.org.nz. And otherwise, please listen to our radio on every Friday, 8:40 to 9:10. And our website for the program is www.planetaudio.org.nz/muffintalk. Thank you all for listening, and have a beautiful day.